The University of Montana will host a conversation with Ambassador David O'Sullivan on Thursday, September 28th in the Montana Theater. Mr. O'Sullivan is the European Union Ambassador to the United States. The discussion will be facilitated by Missoula resident and author Michael Punk, a fellow diplomat and former U.S. Ambassador to the World Trade Organization. Ambassador O'Sullivan will speak to us about his upcoming visit and a few key issues facing the EU. Ambassador O'Sullivan, thank you for taking time today.
Thank you. Great to be talking to you.
So earlier this week, the president of the European Union, Jean-Claude Juncker, delivered a State of the Union address in which he presented a positive overall outlook for the EU, in fact saying the wind is back in European sails. If you take a moment and provide some overall reflection on the president's address.
Yes, well, I think this was a very important, positive and upbeat presentation by President Juncker. Since I've come to Washington in 2014, it seems to me that the impression here has been very much of Europe rocked by different crises, whether that was the euro crisis or then the Greek crisis, and then the migration crisis, and also the horrors of terrorist attacks, and then we had the Brexit vote. So there is sometimes the impression created that Europe was in turmoil and that things were not going very well. In fact, I was actually myself back in Brussels just a few weeks ago. I think the mood has very definitely changed. The economy is performing extremely well. Europe is actually now growing slightly faster even than the United States. And for 15 quarters, we've had positive growth across all our member states. Unemployment has come down quite dramatically. The public deficits are much more under control than they were at the height of the crisis. And Europe has a very ambitious trade agenda with many of our partners. The migration crisis is certainly not solved, and there's no room for complacency there, but we are better managing it. We've regained control over our external frontiers. The flow of refugees and migrants has diminished, and we are better able to look after those who are entering our territory and seeking refuge. And in terms of the future of the European Union, I think the 27 member states who will remain after the UK leaves have restated their determination to take the project forward and to strengthen integration in a number of ways. And that's what basically President Juncker was announcing in his speech this week.
And I know that he also praised Italy for their work in what he calls in sort of the what's happening in the Mediterranean, and also reflecting on the economy with unemployment at a 9-year low across the EU. The address seemed to strike a balance of both staying on course with regard to initiatives and progress made to date, but also a bold call to action. In fact, at one point in the address saying, we've started to fix the roof and we must continue while the sun is shining. And he, of course, went on to outline some of the initiatives that will be put forward. Where do you think the highest priority as we move forward in sort of this bold call to action and this balance between what is already being implemented and what still needs to come?
Well, I think you're right to pick up on the fact that President Juncker did say we very much have to complete the ongoing agenda. This commission launched some ambitious projects for Europe, Energy Union, to turn to create a single energy market across all of our 28 member states, the digital single market to create a true unified digital economic space in Europe, Capital Markets Union, because in Europe we tend to rely rather heavily on bank finance for industry, in contrast to the United States, where you rely much more on capital, liquid capital markets. The objective would be to strike a better balance between those two sources of financing for industry. And these are very important initiatives which are, you know, well on the way to being implemented. At the same time, I think President Juncker's message was very important. Sometimes the impetus for reform and change drops off when times get better, because people think, oh, things are not so bad, you know, and then it's only when the next crisis comes that you suddenly realize there was additional work to do. And I think that's his message. So particularly in the area of economic and monetary union and banking union, where there's unfinished business which needs to be addressed, he emphasized the need to take this in hand. There's a whole area of security and defense, where everyone has agreed that Europe needs to shoulder a bigger responsibility for our own defense work, particularly, of course, in close coordination with NATO. But there are ways in which work on defence at the European Union level could add value to our overall defence spend and contribute to the NATO commitment of increasing defence expenditure. So these are just some of the areas which have been highlighted.
A very small amount of time during the address was spent on climate change, but no less impactful. The president had mentioned, in fact, ratification of the Paris Agreement, referring also to some challenges with the U.S. In fact, I think mentioning a collapse of ambition related to the Paris Agreement, but certainly redoubling the effort by the EU related to climate change. Can you talk about some of the specifics around addressing climate change and what the EU is, the initiatives that are being, you know, put forward?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, climate change is a reality. We've just seen some of the horrific storms experienced in the southern part of the United States and in the Caribbean. And I know that in the Northwest, you've had terrible problems with forest fires. I was myself in Vancouver and in Washington State just over the summer, and I saw at first hand the difficulties people were having with the forest fires. So I think this is, unfortunately, a reality that we are going to have to address. Europe has been in the forefront of dealing with this. We have already considerably reduced our carbon emissions. We have moved towards greater use of renewable energy, cutting down on automobile emissions, energy efficiency in homes. These are all the many things that need to be done in order to slow down the global warming and the warming of the planet and containing it below the 2 degrees increase, which beyond which we know things are going to get very difficult, frequently for the most disadvantaged countries and the poorest countries. The countries which are currently suffering most are in Africa or in the Pacific, and these are the countries that can least cope with these kind of dramatic changes. So Europe is fully committed to this. We are disappointed at the announced possible withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Agreement, but we hope that we can continue to work with this administration, but also with the many governors and cities across the United States who've announced their intention to continue on this path of CO2 emission reductions. And I must say, I'm very encouraged when I see what is actually happening in America on a day-to-day basis. Cities and states are taking the kind of decisions needed.
Indeed. And I think I want to shift gears for a moment. While no direct references truly to Brexit were made during the address, I know that that is on everyone's mind. In fact, I know Prime Minister Theresa May will soon travel to Italy to speak in Florence with an update and what they're calling a hope for sort of jumpstarting that process. What could you frame up sort of the biggest challenges with the UK exit and what that's going to mean and sort of the barriers that need to be overcome? And I guess your hopes for or your what you foresee as the progress that's going to be made or not with Brexit in the coming months.
Well, as President Juncker said in his speech, we are saddened by the decision of the British people. We regret that they have chosen to leave the European Union. It is, of course, their sovereign right to do so, and we respect their democratic decision. But we don't think it's a happy decision for them or for us. And I want to be clear that there is probably no upside to this decision. We are largely in a situation of damage limitation, trying to minimize the damage both to the United Kingdom, but in the end they will have to look after their own future, but particularly, of course, for the rest of us, the 27. And speaking as an Irishman, Brexit has huge implications for the island of Ireland, the peace process, and Ireland's relationship, particularly trading relationship with the UK. But the same can be said for many other countries who will be directly affected by this decision. The negotiations have not gone very well because, unfortunately, there is still a debate raging in the UK as to exactly how they want to take this process forward. And until that is more clear, it's difficult for the European side, Chief Negotiator Michel Barnier, to sketch out how we could address the many problems. I mean, frankly, Paula, it's an absolutely gargantuan task this for the UK to withdraw from the EU. I mean, there are so many aspects of daily and commercial life that are intimately linked to being a member of the European Union that this is a huge challenge. And the time frame ahead of us, which is 2 years starting from the 29th of March of this year, so the 29th of March 2019, which is frankly, 18 months away, it's very daunting to see how we can crunch through the different issues, especially as the UK has said that they do want to completely leave the single market, the customs union, and to completely rebuild a new trading relationship with Europe through a comprehensive trade deal. Now, I'm a former trade negotiator, and a comprehensive trade deal of this scale normally takes, 5 to 7 years to negotiate. If you look at TPP, if you look at NAFTA, if you look at our recent agreement with Canada, that's the kind of time frame you're talking of. So how do we manage the transition between the moment when we would have completed that sort of ambitious negotiation five or six years down the road and the deadline of end of March 2019 when the UK is going to leave? And that's why there's huge focus now on the transition measures that might be put in place. But much does depend on what the how the UK wants to manage this. And we are looking forward to Mrs. May's speech in Florence next week and hoping that she will be able to shed some further light on how the UK proposes to deal with these issues.
And certainly there are some that are still advocating for what they've called a hard or a clean Brexit, but much more talk, it seems, has emerged over perhaps a soft Brexit and maybe some sort of transitional period that is longer. Does that seem more likely than maybe sort of this hard and fast process with this deadline 18 months away? It seems like maybe more of a transition, at least in some areas, that won't be maybe fully implemented beyond that deadline that's approaching.
Well, I think if you talk to business, they will tell you that jumping off the edge of a cliff on the 30th of March 2019 would be the worst thing possible for the United Kingdom. So for those in the United Kingdom who advocate, as you say, a hard Brexit, I think it will bring massive problems. On the other hand, there are political problems to a transition which could be presented in the UK as not delivering the Brexit, which was supported by a majority, not a very large majority, but by the majority in the referendum. So much of this is driven by domestic British politics, and that's why on for the EU27, we're sort of waiting to see what can the British propose as a possible transition measure. And of course, on our side, we also have our interests to look after and defend. We would like the best possible relationship with the United Kingdom once they leave, but it has to be very clear, you cannot leave the European Union and continue to have the benefits of membership. There are consequences to the decision to leave, and these will have to be assumed by the United Kingdom, and this is going to mean that they have less easy access to the largest single market in the world, which is the European Union. There is going to be new trade barriers and obstacles which will have to be put in place, which will reflect the fact that the UK is no longer a full member of the European Union with all the many advantages that that brings.
And I know that that will be a topic of much discussion and inquiry when you visit the University of Montana a little bit later this month. I want to talk about the EU's human rights policy, and specifically I read a transcript of your remarks in Washington, D.C. earlier this summer about the priority of abolishing the death penalty as a key objective in your policy. In fact, you stated all crimes are best fought through a functioning judicial system and not through taking a life. The EU has made substantial investment and gain. Can you speak about that as a priority for the EU and also what you have done and or continue to do to perhaps convince countries like the United States to similarly adopt a ban on the death penalty?
Well, I think we are, as President Juncker said in his speech, we are a European Union based on values, and human rights is a very important part of that. And we believe that the abolition of the death penalty should be the hallmark of a modern and civilized judicial system. Indeed, you cannot join the European Union unless you have abolished the death penalty. It's one of the requirements for membership of the European Union by any country that aspires to join. And we say this for good reason, that It's not that we are not horrified by the many crimes that are committed by people who would potentially be subject to the death penalty. But all the evidence is, one, that it's not a deterrent, and secondly, it is irreversible. And in all our justice systems, unfortunately, we have very many examples of people who are wrongly convicted and then tragically executed if the death penalty exists, only for it to be discovered several years later, or in some cases many years later, these people were innocent. And this is really a very fundamental principle for us. So we continue here in the United States to pass this message. I mean, of course, at the end of the day, it is a matter for, and under your system, for each individual state of your 50 states of the union to decide their policy in this issue, and we respect it. It's not for us to tell you what you should do, but we will continue to repeat our strong view that this is not a means of judicial punishment which should be on the statute books of democratic and forward-looking countries, including like the United States. So we'll continue to try to persuade people. But I know it's a difficult debate, and I've heard many people in America give me the opposite view, and we're respectful of that.
Well, I know that we're short on time today, but I also wanted to mention first, of course, we're honored that you'll be able to take some time to visit with us on the University of Montana campus coming up on September 28th. Anything else you'd like to add about that evening, which is sort of designed to be a conversation? There will be opportunities, in fact, ample opportunities for question and answer and discussion. And what are you hoping to learn from, perhaps from Montanans, or to certainly share with us while you're here?
Well, look, I'm really looking forward to getting, it's not my first trip to Montana. In fact, I have some very good friends, Dan Wilcox and Maida Kaplan, who are long-term residents of Missoula, whom I knew first on a YMCA summer camp in Chicago, where we were camp counselors. And I actually came back to visit them in 1982 in the winter. And I spent a very pleasant week in Missoula. I look forward to catching up with them. I look forward to getting. I loved Missoula when I was there. I'm looking delighted to get back. And I'm particularly happy on this occasion to be reconnecting with Ambassador Michael Punk, who is a great friend and colleague through long and difficult trade negotiations. And I hope, you know, the whole point, Paul, of these trips is for me to listen to people outside of Washington, outside of D.C. So I'm very interested in hearing how Montanans see some of the issues we've been talking about, relations with Europe, climate change, these issues. So I hope I can bring some information and knowledge about Europe, but I will also be very much listening to the messages that people want to pass to me and how Montanans see their state and the United States and its role in the world, which is so important for all of us.
Ambassador, I want to say thank you again for your time today. I know that there will be great interest in the upcoming event here at the University of Montana.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes. Speaking to David O'Sullivan, the European Union Ambassador to the United States, the University of Montana will host a conversation with Ambassador O'Sullivan on Thursday, September 28th in the Montana Theater. The event begins at 7 o'clock. Information available on the events page of the University of Montana website at umt.edu/events.